Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you ace your exams at school and university through the psychology of high performance and the science of studying smarter, not harder. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the Cambridge-trained memory psychologist and exam success coach, William Wadsworth!
Hello and welcome back to the Memory and Learning series here on the Exam Study Experts podcast. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode on the fundamentals of memory with Peps McRae. The next couple of episodes for you are a very special pair. To set the scene, let me take you back to 2013, when a very special research paper was published by a starry collaboration of academics, John Donlosky, Catherine Rawson, Elizabeth Marsh, Mitchell Nathan, and a certain Daniel Willingham. The paper was a massive review of all relevant published studies that put various learning strategies to the test. The authors of that review looked at 10 different learning strategies, from retrieval practice through to rereading, and sifted through all the evidence from over 400 separate published studies, and tried to summarise how each of those 10 strategies, how well each of those 10 strategies worked. Regular listeners to the show won't be surprised by the results. Up at the top of the list, when ranked by utility or usefulness, were things like retrieval practice and spaced repetition. And then down at the bottom, rated as relatively low effective, were techniques like rereading, highlighting, and making summary notes. The lead author of that paper, John Donlosky, went on to write, I guess, a more kind of public-facing summary of findings for a non-academic audience called Strengthening the Student Toolbox. Now, together, these two works, the original paper and the Strengthening the Student Toolbox summary of recommendations, together they proved phenomenally influential in the world of education and evidence-based study practices generally. That original review article, Donlosky and colleagues 2013, has been cited an incredible 4,270 times, which is what makes it one of the most impactful works ever published in psychology. And on a personal note, it's also been a paper that has had a massive impact on my own life and my own journey, because it went, in fact, when I was deciding to start Exam Study Expert as a full-time venture back in 2018 and having these kind of conversations with myself about where life was going to go, 6 years ago now, I was carrying around a printout of Donlosky et al.'s conclusion section, folded up in my jacket pocket and covered in highlighter. And if an article can convince someone to quit their job and launch a venture like it did for me, I think that's some article. So today's guest is a gentleman called Amarbir Singh Gill, who has written effectively a user guide to Donlosky's Strengthening the Student Toolbox called Donlosky's Strengthening the Student Toolbox in Action, part of the Walkthroughs series edited by Tom Sherrington and aimed at teachers. So the book is aimed as sort of more of a teacher audience. So if you're a teacher, I highly recommend picking up that book if you're interested in this topic. But today, Singh is helping us to unpack the lessons for students. And in particular, I'm going to be focusing with him on some of the lesser known strategies from the set of 10. So we're not going to be focusing right at the top of the list, retrieval practice, spacing, because we cover those quite frequently here on the show. I'm interested today with Singh in kind of digging into some of the middle strategies, things like interleaving, elaborative interrogation, and more. Things that could still be effective, but perhaps are a little bit more situational in when they apply. Briefly, before we dive in, I just wanted to say that next week, I'm going to be absolutely thrilled to be introducing the man himself, lead author of that famous 2013 paper, John Donlosky, here on the podcast, and I'll be asking him all about his research and some of his really excellent practical thinking that he's developed over the years about applying it and putting all his strategies into action. It's a highly practical, very, very interesting episode, and yeah, I'm thrilled to have one of my kind of academic heroes here on the show. So do look out for that episode next week. So for today, to help us warm up for that paper and a fantastic interview in its own right, Singh's incredibly generous with his own advice and some of his really interesting thoughts on kind of applying Donlosky's work and putting it into action. Really excited to welcome Singh to the show. Let's dive right in.
Hi everyone, my name is Singh, full name Amarbir Singh Gill. I live and teach in the southeast of the country, southeast of London. So I currently work for Ambition Institute and Haberdashers Academies South Trust, supporting maths departments, but really I'm a maths teacher. Like that's what I enjoy doing, that's what I really care about, is helping kids get better at maths and teaching maths.
Amazing. Well, I'd love to come back and talk a little bit more about maths specifically in a minute.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I got in touch was, you know, we have a shared interest in the seminal work of John Donosky and colleagues. I was just wondering, tell me about, so, you know, you first kind of came across the Strengthening the Student Toolbox paper. Tell me about kind of when you first came across it and what it meant to you at the time. Was it something that kind of really excited you on first reading, or was it more of a sort of thing that sort of grew on you over time?
I think definitely the former. So I started teaching in 2014, and then I took up a master's in expert teaching in early 2018. And prior to that, like, hadn't really engaged with educational research. Like, I might read an article if a colleague recommends it, or, you know, if it was lying around in the staff room, but I hadn't really engaged with sort of solid educational research in this sort of sense. And I started this master's program. It was an absolutely brilliant master's. And this was like the first paper that we were given, or like one of the first papers we were given. And I thought it was just brilliant. Like, I just thought the way that Professor Donosky had written it, the way it was communicated, like, it wasn't in, you know, really academic, really horrible language. Like, I could get to grips with it, having not, you know, not been immersed in that world for very long at all. And it was just really accessible, really easy to get to grips with. And it specifically spoke about maths in one of the parts as well. So when in the article he talks about interleaving, he uses the examples of maths. And me being a maths teacher and like my own ridiculous bias, like, I was just hooked straight away. Like, he knew his audience. And I was just captivated. I thought, this is brilliant. Like, this is what educational research is producing. Like, I'm here for it. And that's really where the rest of sort of my journey grew from there. But that was definitely the thing that really opened my door to evidence-informed practice and educational research.
So I think it's probably fair to characterize the strategies they present in that work as sort of a spectrum from really effective, you want to be doing quite a bit of this, so things like retrieval practice,
yeah,
spaced learning, through to things that are much less effective. And you know, while they may have a place in your overall learning system, we certainly don't want to be devoting too much focus to them. So things like rereading, highlighting. I think it's fair to say also that the top couple of strategies, you know, retrieval practice, spaced learning, get talked about a lot. And we talk about them a lot on the podcast as well. You know, I've recorded episodes on them. I've had guests talking about them. It's something we covered quite a lot. I thought what might be quite interesting to start with today is maybe some of those ones in the middle,
yeah,
where they may have some use, but perhaps in slightly more specific circumstances, and just kind of air those a little bit. So I wondered if we could maybe start with elaborative interrogation and self-explanation. So just sort of tell us a little bit about what these things are and when they might be helpful.
Yeah, definitely. And I think some context to frame it. One of the things that I think Professor Donosky did in the original paper, but also when we were having conversations about the book, like, him and I sort of emphasized, was, as you said, like, this is a spectrum. It's not saying like these are good strategies and these are bad strategies. They are strategies that will work differently to meet a different purpose. Like, if you've got nothing to retrieve, you're not going to benefit from retrieval practice.
Right.
Like, you're probably better off rereading. And the reason some of those sort of middle strategies happened is not to say that they were sort of less effective than others or more effective than others. The reason they got put into the middle was because the evidence at the time, and, you know, 10 years is a long time in academic research, and the evidence at the time wasn't robust enough to put it up there with, you know, the two that were up, the retrieval practice and distributive practice. Because of things like, you know, there just hadn't been enough research, potentially. Or there had been a lot of research, but it was in a really small domain. Like, it hadn't been as widely replicated as the other two. So elaborative interrogation and self-explanation, like, one of those or two of those techniques that seemed like they had a lot of potential. Like, they sort of theoretically made sense why they would be helpful. But at the time, there wasn't necessarily a lot of research to push them into that higher tier. However, I think they are absolutely brilliant when used appropriately. A, because I think they're things that, to be honest, a lot of students will probably be doing anyway without realizing. So essentially what we're talking about, elaborative interrogation, is can I elaborate on the thing that I'm thinking about now? So can I make connections between what I'm thinking about now and knowledge I already have, my existing knowledge, or potentially different bits of new knowledge that I have? So rather than I'm not trying to think about and process, you know, four or five different things, I might be doing that, but in the broader context of like one thing. And this inherently like makes sense for the same reasons that, you know, retrieval practice makes sense, for the same reasons that distributed practice makes sense. The more we think about stuff, the more likely we are to remember it. And the more things that we can attach to that stuff, like the more other bits of information we can attach to that stuff, the more likely we are to remember it. Because now we're not remembering like random bits of information in isolation. We're remembering connections. So a typical example might be like in maths, I'm not going to pretend to teach anything else because I don't want to embarrass myself. But in maths, let's say I'm teaching, you know, trigonometry. Now, there might be an argument to say, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to teach how to use sine first and then cosine and then tan. And that might be effective. I want to caveat with this by saying, like, this is not a recommendation for how to teach or how to learn. This is just an example of elaborative interrogation. The other argument could say, actually, what we want to do is teach all three together, because in doing so, we help make connections between those different things because they are inherently related. So it wouldn't make sense to do, for example, sine, cosine, tan, and then something like quadratic equations. The links between them are a bit more tenuous, potentially not even there, but those three are inherently linked. So actually, as I'm learning one and I'm thinking, oh, you know, oh, this makes sense because I did something similar when I was working, when I was using sine, or I did something similar when I was using tan. Like that process of making those links and connections, that's what's helpful. That's where the power of self-explanation lies. And I think in that example, you can probably see the overlap of self-explanation and elaborative interrogation. So I think sometimes there can be a temptation to like really separate these things out as like, oh, you know, now I'm going to do self-explanation, or now I'm going to do elaborative interrogation. And like the truth is, I don't think that really matters. But the thing that matters most is, are we thinking about how this information relates to other information we already know? And also, why? Like, why is this thing happening? What does it mean to connect this idea to an existing idea? So that's like a whistle-stop tour of these techniques. But I think sort of, yeah, summarizes it. Like, essentially, can I make connections with other existing knowledge? And can I also explain to myself why this thing is the way it is?
So I'm a psychologist by trade, and I did quite a bit of biology as well at various points. And so an example of a really hard thing to learn that always comes to my mind is learning the kind of the metabolic pathways. I remember learning that at A-level when I was at high school. And, you know, you've got this huge, you know, you've got kind of phosphorylation, and then you've got Krebs cycle and loads of molecules with kind of obscure terms. It's kind of a great big memory challenge. And I guess the kind of the go-to effective strategy for getting that to stick would just be like, probably blank page retrieval, grabbing a blank big sheet of paper and just trying to write it out from memory and then look at the gaps and then have another go.
Yeah.
Thinking of, as you were talking about how I might apply the idea of kind of elaborative interrogations, kind of asking those why questions to something like that, I guess what you might do off the back of that is say, well, you know, why is this important in the body? What function does it have? Well, it's to generate ATP. It's to generate ATP for energy. That allows your muscles to contract. That allows, you know, da, 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 all these different processes. And actually, this was something I remember. It's always stuck in my head. This was something my biology teacher, and when I was at school, used to do quite well. Like he'd kind of do these little nice little narrations. So anytime we'd kind of coming towards the end of introducing a new bit of material into a new conceptual framework or whatever, he'd always then kind of do a little narration at the end, kind of linking back in what we learned to things we'd learned before, you know, oh, and this generates ATP. And then he'd go off and list all the things that ATP does in the body. And then if we'd learned about muscle contraction, he'd start to talk about that. And just kind of really quickly in like 30 seconds, like ping, 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 linking all these other little things. So I think it's quite interesting. I think for that example, for Krebs cycle, you need both. You need both the just the kind of knowing the names of the molecules, because that's important and that matters. Yeah. Without that, you haven't really got that concept. But then you also need to kind of have that more conceptual, higher level, where does this fit into the big picture? Why is this important? And that's where the kind of elaborative interrogation bit might come in.
Yeah.
Does that seem like a reasonable interpretation for a different example, for a kind of a non-math subject? Would that seem like a reasonable way of thinking about it?
For sure. Like definitely like giving me flashbacks of my like biology A-level days. But yeah, like for sure. I think the key thing is, you know, so what you said at the end, there may be a point where like we just need to know those words as key terminology, right? Like that key vocabulary. And if we don't, like that might be somewhere where like we just go to a textbook or we just go to our notes and we just read that thing. But then once we've got to that point, once we've got those things, we then ask those questions of like, well, how does this thing link to that thing? And why are these all connected? And again, the key thing is, I come back to the idea of, the more you think about something and the harder you think about it, the more likely you are to retain it. So it's not just the case of, you know, I want to be thinking about a word over and over again. But because you're thinking about the connections that that word has, or you think about in the wider context of the cycle that you mentioned, that's where that really powerful tool comes in to retain and solidify that knowledge.
Absolutely. So you mentioned maths.
Yeah.
I wonder if you've got any other thoughts on what's good for learning maths.
So like the number one thing, as with anything, right, is practice. I think maths just lends itself really well to that, because like it's much easier to do a bunch of maths questions than it is to like practice a whole essay. Maths does have certain advantages. So the number one thing is just practicing. However, there are ways you can like supercharge that practice as well. So often, for example, you might get a textbook exercise, and in textbooks, they will, like, let's say you're learning, really basic example, you're learning fractions, and they'll have like chapter 1.1, additional fractions, chapter 1.2, subtraction, 1.3, division, 1.4, multiplication. So you've got all fractions, all different operations, but they're blocked, right, by operation. And essentially what our brain does is sort of process the first three, maybe four questions, and then we run on autopilot. Like we just know what's coming next, and so we're running on autopilot. Instead, what we could do is we could use those questions to make our own. So we might pick two from the addition, and then we might pick three from the subtraction, and then like two from division, and then three from multiplication, and then repeat that. But crucially, again, we can't just follow a pattern. So I can't always do two addition, two subtraction, two multiplication, two division, or whatever the order is. Because as soon as we get into any sort of pattern, again, like our brain will recognize it and we'll start running on autopilot. We won't get that same benefit. What we could do is completely randomize it. So that's why it's like pick two from somewhere, three from somewhere else, and then just jumble it up. And you only actually need to have like a few questions. You can get benefits from having much fewer questions than if you're blocking. Because what we're forcing ourselves to do each time, and this technique is called interleaving, right? So this is what research would probably suggest as an example of interleaving. And so what we're doing each time is first, we're having to figure out what the question's asking us to do, right? So we have to recognize the cues, the bits of information in the question. And then once we recognize that, we have to load up the right memory, the right bit of knowledge in our brain. Oh, so that's an addition question, which means I have to use X technique. So once we've done those two things, we then actually have to execute it. And we're having to do that for each question because there's no pattern. We can't run on autopilot. In fact, if we run on autopilot, we'll get things wrong. And actually, it's probably helpful. So you probably will get more things wrong when you're doing things like interleaving. But it's not because like you don't necessarily understand the technique. What's probably happened is you haven't registered, like your brain's gone into autopilot. And so you haven't actually registered the question. So it might be a division question and you've used an addition technique because you didn't properly register the question in the first place. The research backs that up. So the research actually says the types of errors that are made in blocked practice, so when you're doing like one operation followed by another, versus interleaved are different. So you are more likely to make like actual errors to do with like the maths if you're doing blocked, and you might make more careless errors, we might say, when doing interleaved study. There is, however, like a massive caveat with this in that, firstly, all of these things fall down if you're just like getting things wrong.
If you can't do one on its own, you won't be able to do them interleaved.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, sometimes having that like one operation followed by another can be really helpful just to develop, get the engine started and warmed up, so to speak. The second thing is, it's not like just a random mixing up of things. So I intentionally chose fractions because they are so closely related. If I was to mix up like the additional fractions with solving quadratic equations, they're not related. I'm not really doing myself any favors by, in inverted commas, interleaving those. I wouldn't class it as interleaving, because the key feature of interleaving is, can I understand why I do this for that question and something different for a different question when those questions are very, very similar? So can I understand why I'm finding a common denominator when I'm adding or subtracting fractions, but not when I am dividing or multiplying? Like, that process in our brain is fundamental. So it's not just like, this has to be done really carefully. I got this wrong. Like, I got this completely wrong when I first started out doing it. And so I try really hard to make sure people don't make the same mistakes that I did, because I did just randomly mix stuff up when I was first started out doing it. Like, probably one of those powerful things in maths is to try and recognize where there might be patterns and where you can sort of stop your brain from going into autopilot.
I think interleaving is one of the, I think probably of all these strategies, I think that's the one that I see getting most commonly misunderstood. The amount of times I've been in a conference and, you know, an otherwise very intelligent, well, very well put together presentation, and, you know, they'll start to talk about interleaving, and they'll either be thinking about it in terms of, well, it's like dividing up your lessons. So you do like 20 minutes on topic A, 20 minutes on topic B, 20 minutes on topic C, or, you know, it's kind of like a lesson plan across the week. So you'll be spending one day on topic A, one day on topic B, one day on topic C. And
yeah,
that's not interleaving. Like, that's never been what the cognitive psychology literature means by interleaving. And people will then say, well, you know, so interleaving, will discredit interleaving because, you know, they find it's too confusing, or they say, well, there isn't really an evidence base for it. And there might not be an evidence base for that interpretation of the practice, but there's great evidence for what interleaving is supposed to mean.
Yeah.
That's just my little weird hill that I'll die on. Like, this is what interleaving means.
I mean, I was guilty of it when I started. I remember for the first time, and I've spoken I've written a blog on my website about this as well. Like, the first time I did interleaving, it was an absolute car crash, because I'd fallen in, I think, into the trap that I think many, if not all, teachers can relate to, which is teachers are time and resource poor. We see something that we think is going to help our students, and so we want to do it as quickly as possible. And so we read the sort of headlines, maybe like the summaries, and we don't necessarily give ourselves that permission and that time to engage with like the nuance. And what happens then is you get things like, you know, what I did. I think the first time I did it, I think it's something outrageous. Like, I think I was mixing up Pythagoras and probability trees in a lesson.
Right.
And surprise to no one, like it was probably the worst lesson I've ever taught. Like, just absolute car crash. So I quickly learned my lesson. But I mean, like, you know, this was when I was earlier on in my career. I think I was working part time because I was doing it with the masters. So I had that time and that freedom to engage a bit critically with my own practice and with that research. And it is also, it's just a really hard thing. Like, it is to sit and think about, how can I design this task, or how can I make some practice alongside all the other things that, you know, you're doing either as a teacher or as a student. Like, it's a lot of investment for something that is really challenging. Like, students will get stuff wrong. That's partly the point of it. But then if you're a student, like, to keep yourself motivated, that's really hard. Like, you have to understand, this is not a short term. You could just sit and block it, right, and do one operation after the other, and you'll get better in the short term, 100%. But this is not a short term gain, right? Like, your knowledge isn't built up over days or weeks. It's built up over months and years. And similarly for teachers, like, having to keep a class of, you know, 25, 30, 35 kids motivated when they're getting stuff wrong, it's a real challenge. It is a real challenge. So, yeah, I think interleaving is often coming misunderstood. Like, I definitely misunderstood it when I started off. And it is because, like, it is a hard thing to understand. Yeah, for sure.
Is there anything else, either from your experience or from the evidence base, that you find comes in handy for maths that you want to share?
Yeah, I think, well, one of the things with maths is, like, how people prepare for, like, revision, essentially, like, how people revise. And I think specifically, I often see students and going away and doing lots and lots of exam practice, right? They'll do loads and loads of exam practice. They'll find past papers, practice papers. And again, this is like going back to that spectrum we talked about earlier. This is not to say, no, don't do past papers. Like, definitely do past papers. But actually, this is not a case of, like, you do one past paper, you mark it and you go on to the next one, and then you do that one and you mark it and you go on to the next one. That's probably not going to be very helpful. What you might be better off doing is, if you still want to use exam papers, is using them. And then when you get stuck on a topic, figuring out, okay, what is this question asking? And then going and practicing that topic before coming back. So you're using an exam paper not to familiarize yourself with the exam, but to identify, actually, this is what I might need more work on.
Yeah.
In all honesty, probably even better than that is just getting a list of topics from, you know, Corbett Maths, Mr. Bartlett. There's so many websites like Khan Academy, loads of fantastic websites. And then just working your way through some of those topics. And when you get stuck, like going and asking for some help. Because the tricky thing with practice papers is they're really good, but sometimes questions will involve lots of different bits of knowledge and they're all sort of knotted up. And so it can be difficult to figure out, well, actually, you know, what do I need to improve on? Like, what's the thing that I really need to work on? And you're probably better, actually, if you've gone away, if you've just solidified your knowledge about maths in general beforehand, that exam question will probably be more easier than when you next come to it. So I think that's probably one of the big things is we feel like, and one of the big things about that paper is some of those less effective strategies are like brilliant masters of the con, because what they make us feel is we're really good. They result in really, really quick boosts in performance. So I can reread something and then magically when I close that book, I can recall almost everything, right? Whereas if I practice, if I do a practice test, almost definitely not going to happen. A, I'm going to find it harder, and B, I'm going to get things wrong. So it makes us feel like we're not doing as well. And similarly, exams can make us feel like we're doing better because, or practice papers, sorry, can make us feel like we're doing better because we're doing the thing that we will be doing in the hall in a few weeks or months time, as opposed to like just practice, which can seem unrelated. But actually, like, that's really probably going to be the more helpful thing. So if you set yourself up and, you know, you pick two topics a week that you're then going to come to, and you do, you know, what you said earlier, which is you distribute it. So you say, right, I'm going to do these two topics this week, and then I'm going to come back to them. Depending on, like, if you really struggle, you might come back to them next week. If they're okay, you might come back to them in a month's time or so. And you get into that habit like early on, you'll probably put yourself in a much better position than doing a past paper every week. Like, it's probably not going to be as beneficial for your learning.
So it's kind of like a pyramid. You want to have that base layer really solid, you know, that base layer of, can I do all the topics on their own? Have I really mastered each of these individually before you then layer on your, well, can I put all this together in an exam situation under time conditions and all the other little things that come into play with the real exam?
Yeah, and I think that's probably, for me, and I know this opinion may not be shared.
I love a controversial opinion.
Like, the real value in practice papers and practice exam papers is not like figuring out how much you know or figuring out where the gaps in your knowledge are. It's how will I cope with exam conditions? How will I cope with no access to resources, under timed conditions, like in silence? Like, that's really, I think, the value in doing practice. If you're not doing practice tests in those conditions, I think for me, it misses the purpose of what they serve, because that's what they've been designed to do, right? Like, they've been designed to be done in that way and to put you in a certain mindset when you are doing them. So I think for me, that's where their value lies more so than sort of, I think, other ways in which they are used. But yeah, that's probably my controversial opinion for the day.
No, that's great advice. I think that's great advice. I mean, just as an aside, like, I see a lot of people going around teaching good revision technique, and they're like, oh, you know, just get a bunch of past papers and do them interminably. And I'm like, well, I mean, it's like, yeah, like, it's not the worst thing you could be doing. Like, there are definitely worse ways to revise. But also,
yeah,
there's some nuance that's missing. You know? Anyway.
And the thing I find really interesting is actually, for me as a maths teacher, and I don't know if this is applicable in different subjects, I think the difference in doing that between like GCSE maths and A-level maths. So I think in A-level maths, the questions are less, like, there's less window dressing done to the questions, right? Like, it's here's the maths, can you, like, answer the maths?
It's not John and Sarah are in the shops and they want to buy a...
Right. Exactly. And I find that really strange. Like, I don't quite know why it happens at GCSE, but yeah, it happens all the time. But and the crucial thing is, those sort of questions, like, this is why exam papers aren't always helpful, because those questions at GCSE, you have to like first look past the window dressing to get to the maths and then do the maths. But actually, looking past the window dressing is probably like the easier bit, because if you can do that and you still don't get the maths, like, then you're still stuck. But actually, in getting familiar with the maths, like that's the thing that will help you look past the window dressing, because you'll start to see, oh, that question looks really similar to this question I did last week or, you know, 2 weeks ago. And so you'll start to spot those patterns again, and that's what will help you. I think that's why using exam paper to practice isn't necessarily as helpful as like doing the maths and then starting to make those connections between, well, this is actually what this question is asking me to do.
The other one I wanted to touch on was mental imagery strategies. So maybe again, just give us a kind of a brief, like, what does that mean? And then what are the kind of circumstances under which that might be a helpful thing to be doing?
Yeah. So mental imagery is where basically you associate an image or images with a particular bit of knowledge. And this was rated as less effective by Donosky. And the crucial thing, again, is this is not because it's not a good strategy. One of the main reasons it was rated as less effective was because its application is probably quite limited. So an example that stuck with me is last week I was on holiday in Italy and I saw a person making their way through the crowd and they were saying the word permesso. And so I sort of realized, well, they're probably saying something along the lines of excuse me, like, can I get past? And whenever I now think of that word permesso, I think of that man making his way through the crowd. So I associated that image with this word for me. What will probably happen is, as I become more familiar with the word, like as I, you know, if I think it's probably the best, if I become fluent in Italian, I won't have that image. I won't need to have that image to cue that word because it will just be automated. But actually for now, like as a beginner learning Italian, for me to be like, oh, you know, like if I want to say excuse me when I'm in a crowd or if I want to get past someone, what can I do? And I think of that image and I remember that word, probably really, really helpful. Or language is also some of the common examples used in the original Donosky paper as well. So I think he gives example of French and la dent for like teeth. And what we might do is associate like la dent with dentist. And so we make that connection of like, oh, well, that sounds like similar to dentist. A dentist deals with teeth, so you've got teeth. So, like, really, really helpful. And I think in maths, and sorry, I know I keep going back to maths.
No, that's great.
Yeah, I just love maths. So maths, like, we probably do this unconsciously all the time. Because if I was to say, like, Pythagoras, everyone who hears that word immediately will probably think of a right-angle triangle in their head. Like, they'll probably picture a right-angle triangle in their head. Similarly, if I say trigonometry, like you're thinking of triangles and you might conjure up images of like, oh, you know, this is how this would relate to like opposite, adjacent and hypotenuse or something like that. If I say quadratic graph, like you might picture a curve. These are all examples of us associating images with bits of knowledge. But in doing so, we make it, again, easier. Coming back to those cues, we've got two cues. So I've got like the word quadratic graph and the image to represent the same bit of knowledge, which means I have multiple ways to recall that information. So it's easier for me to remember it because I've got multiple like target points for the same thing.
So this is the idea of dual coding, isn't it? So we've got two different routes to both learning and recall based on the idea that there's kind of different, almost like different thinking pathways. You've got the kind of phonological loop, which is about word stuff, and then the visual spatial sketchpad, which is about kind of imagery. And you can, you know, when you see information presented in both of those modalities, like it just gives you those two different routes, both to kind of learn it in the first place, and then also to recall it later. So you might recall the word, or you might recall the image. It kind of gives you some option. And there's definitely some evidence that that's sort of a helpful thing to be doing. And then I think more generally with the, you know, with the kind of imagery thing, like, I think one way to, I guess, have an image in your head for what that's doing is, I always think of it as a bit like a stepping stone in the river. So if the river's kind of quite wide to jump across, you need kind of a clue. You need like a stepping stone. And so you jump onto the stepping stone. You remember, oh yeah, now I remember my little image that I have for this. I remember the dentist. And then you go, oh yeah. And then that's daunt, isn't it? And so it just makes it easier to kind of do that river crossing, if you like.
Yeah, no, it's exactly that. And I think that analogy is really helpful because the goal is not the stepping stone.
Yeah.
The goal is the other side of the river, right? And we're using this as a stepping stone, as a scaffold to get to our goal. And that's one of the key things that Professor Donosky emphasized in his original paper is if we limit it to the goal as a stepping stone, the usage of it becomes really narrow. And actually we miss the wider context on the wider purpose we're trying to serve. So like if I just teach all of my French or Italian vocabulary, if I just learn it by associating with images, then when I'm trying to make sentences and I'm trying to like match images with each other, which don't necessarily go, it becomes really tricky. Because that's our goal, is like, how can we speak this language fluently, right? And so if we've used like the sole purpose of vocabulary is through like the medium of images, that becomes really tricky. But if we've always done it in that wider context of like, well, this is to get you started, right? This is to help you get to that point, because after you're going somewhere else, that's really where its power lies.
That's nice. It's, you can sort of see why he called it a toolbox, can't you? You've got all these little tools, and it's not just like you need one tool and you pick your favorite tool and then that's the one you always use. You've kind of got these different tools that work in these different circumstances.
For sure, for sure.
You've got knowledge to learn. You do retrieval practice. Yes. You want to kind of understand how that fits in the big picture. You maybe do some elaboration on that retrieval practice. You know, you've got math problems to practice. You do your interleaving. You've got some new vocabulary to get your head around. You do some mental imagery. So you've got these, all these little tools that have their, each have their purpose.
Yeah. And I think the key thing there is, like you said, like the purpose, right? So I think there's two things that I take away from the toolbox analogy. The first one being, as you said, a tool must be fit for purpose, right? Like, I'm not going to hammer a screw, right? Like, that doesn't make sense. Equally, I'm not going to use a screwdriver for a nail. Like, that doesn't make sense. I have to use the right tool to meet the right purpose. And the second thing is, a tool is only as good as the person using it. And those two, for me, are like really helpful parts of this toolbox analogy. Because, like you say, like we've said throughout the podcast, right? This isn't about good or bad. This is about how can I, like, what do I want to be able to do? And therefore, how can I pick the right tool to in order to do that? And if it's not working, like, I need to go back to that toolbox. If I'm practice testing and I'm just drawing blanks, like, no problem. Let me go and do some rereading. Let me go and do some highlighting. Let me go and do some summarizing. Like, all those things are like have inherent value depending on the purpose that you're trying to meet.
Just a couple of questions to kind of bring us towards a close. Like, one of the concerns that often comes up that I hear when sort of people are maybe sort of starting to learn about this stuff kind of for the first time, maybe they're a teacher that's sort of coming across this for the first time, or, you know, maybe they're a parent and they're sort of coming across it for the first time. So one of the things that some people say is, well, you know, this all sounds very, you know, this all sounds great if you're a confident and capable learner, but, you know, what about if you're kind of disadvantaged, underprivileged, you know, struggling learner, or maybe, you know, there's sort of some neurodiversity, you know, send, what should I do then? Yeah, I just wondered what your kind of perspective was on all this stuff for, I guess, the full diversity of students out there.
I think that's a really important question. Like, I think a lot of the things we've talked about are generally for like neurotypical, people who are neurotypical, right? And I think that isn't to say that these strategies won't benefit students who might have SEND, or, you know, who might have certain backgrounds. I think there are obvious caveats. So if there are, you know, quite serious sort of SEND, then it's a completely different ballgame. Strategies may not work. But in general, and like I really mean it in like the truest sense of the word general, in general, I think the way our thinking happens from person to person is fairly similar, right? The way like our brains process and deal with new and old information is fairly similar. Be that, you know, from a primary school student or a secondary or A-level or university or, you know, an adult learner, anything. The way we deal with and process information is fairly similar. There will always be some differences. There'll be some differences between person to person. But broadly speaking, we're about the same thing. And so the techniques are probably going to be helpful in like in general for most people. I think the biggest factor, rather, in what will be helpful and to what extent it will be helpful is, what do I already know? And what do I want to know? So if I, you know, I'm a fairly young learner and I'm just doing, you know, I'm just getting to grips with like number bonds, learning about Pythagoras' theorem, probably going to be really difficult because I don't really have much knowledge to anchor and to link that to, right? But if, you know, you're an A-level math student and Pythagoras, you could probably do it in your sleep because you're just so familiar with it. It's just so well practiced in your brain. You could probably do it without even realizing you're doing it. Like, you could do it on autopilot. And the reason you've got to that level is because you've had years of practice, right? And when we talk about practice testing, I think often like there's this connotation that it's done in like, you know, this is a quiz. You sit down and you do a quiz, or like it's a test. And actually, that's not the case. Like, practice any time where you are having to do something that requires you to use some information in your brain, without cues available, without access to how to do it elsewhere, you are practice testing. You are getting some information from your brain and putting it on like onto a bit of paper or expressing it out loud. So you've had years and years and years of doing practice testing. Similarly, by the time you get to, you know, year 8, year 9, year 10, you've had years and years and years of doing things like number bonds, things like, you know, your simple times tables. So you're probably going to be really familiar, not because you like, not because of your age, but the key thing is your practice. So you might even be really familiar with those things in year 5 if you've had the last 4 years, all you've done is number bonds and multiplication. You'll probably be brilliant, not because you're like young or old, but because you've had those opportunities to practice over and over and over again. So I think these techniques, with like the caveats we've sort of said around rates of success, of like being mindful of what you do and don't know, are probably going to be helpful for the vast majority of people, exceptional sort of situations and circumstances aside.
My take is that it's almost, you know, I was quite lucky at school. You know, I had a sort of natural aptitude for academics. I could have probably done anything, you know, in terms of revision technique and been okay. And my revision technique wasn't good, knowing what I know now. And you know, I spent all my teenage years drawing gorgeous mind maps. And, you know, I didn't do any retrieval practice at all. And, you know, I was fine. I got 10 A stars at GCSE, 6 A's at A level. I smashed it. but I think I could get away with it. But I don't think everyone's in that boat. And I think if you're someone who struggles academically, I think you kind of need this stuff even more because it's your path to realizing the potential you've got.
Yeah, for sure. And like we say, these techniques aren't, like learning is universal, right? Like everyone will need to learn at some point. And these techniques, for the most part, are equally universal. So we sort of link it to, often when I'm speaking to students when I'm in school, I link it to, you know, sports. Like if anyone plays sports or do like a dance or something like that, you don't wake up one day and you're suddenly good at football. You spend years practicing it, right? Like these amazing athletes, it doesn't happen overnight, and they'll often fail. They'll often be slower or, you know, not as good on some days as others, and they'll have bad days. But it's after years and years of practicing that same thing. And I think the difference with sports or dance or sort of physical activities is it's easier to see the product because like you can see yourself becoming better at football, basketball, rugby, you know, dance, whatever it is. It's much harder to see yourself becoming better at learning because like learning's invisible, right? Like you don't see your brain growing. Your brain doesn't like grow, right? It doesn't get bigger with more knowledge. And so it's much harder to sustain that motivation over that period of time. But that's the key thing is can you just do the same thing you would do if you were an athlete or if you were a dancer or, you know, a musician, like any of these other sort of performance activities? Can you do that practice? And that's what will enable you to get those sort of, you know, growth in knowledge, those results.
It's an exciting time to be on the journey, and thank you on behalf of learners and teachers out there for your contribution to getting the word out there and helping us put all this stuff into action. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a great conversation. If people want to find out a little bit more about the book, about the work you do, where should we go next?
Probably the best place to reach me is on Twitter. So you can find me on Twitter at @SingUmberbG. If you just type my name into Google, to be honest, it will probably come up. My book's also on my Twitter via my link in my account to my blog. All of the profits, all of the profits from my book go to charity as well. So not only will you be like learning some more about learning, you'll also be helping a good cause at the same time. And you can buy it for a discount if you buy it directly from my blog as well.
Well, thanks again, Singh, for that very insightful, very interesting episode. If you are interested in picking up a copy of the book, I've put the link in the show notes. I normally link to where you can buy it on Amazon, but given Singh has offered a discount via his blog, I've just linked directly to that. I just wanted to finish with a quick note on what's coming up this week on the Exam Study Expert podcast. So we've got something a little bit special for you this week. We don't normally do midweek episodes, but we're making an exception this week for a special mini-series aimed not as our usual student listener, but for teachers and educators, exploring how we can teach effective study strategies and looking at the rise of evidence-based practice in education generally, which both real topics I'm really, really excited about and spent a lot of my time thinking about. So it was nice just to be able to feature some of these ideas and some of the big sort of thinkers that are helping progress these ideas on the show over the next few days. So on Tuesday, we'll be talking to Dr. Hayley Hughes about mentoring scholars. On Wednesday, we'll be welcoming Tom Bennett, founder founder of the Research Ed Conference series to the show to talk about the rise of evidence-based practices in education generally. And then on Thursday, we'll be talking about building a Tutor Time study skills program with Katie Holmes. And finally, to round the week off, I'll be with you on Friday in a special episode sharing some of the headline findings from my own research, the Revision Census, and 50,000 student responses to our survey have revealed about how we're doing getting effective study strategies into action and some of the potential barriers that can come up when it comes to getting effective study strategies to work in practice and some suggestions from me about what we can do about that. So if you are a teacher or educator, as I know a proportion of my listeners are, this series should be a real treat for you. I hope you enjoy it. For the majority of our normal listeners, students and scholars themselves, you may yet find this week's episodes quite interesting. So do tune in anyway if you like the sound of any of this. Otherwise, please do mark your calendar for next week's episode, usual time on Sunday, from John Dunlosky himself, which is going to be packed with practical tips from one of the world's absolute top authorities on the science of effective study. That should be a real treat. Hope to see you there. For now, thank you so much, as always, for listening and wishing you every success in your studies.
Wasn't that wonderful? If you're feeling inspired, why not leave us a rating and a review in your podcast app? It would make our day. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.